Welcome to the podcast of the Diane Rehm Show Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists joins Diane to discuss the week's top stories from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new report says casualties among Iraqis killed by violence in Iraq is down sharply from earlier this year. Condoleezza Rice is in Turkey to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to help root out Kurdish separatist rebels. She'll also participate in Monday's regional conference in Istanbul to discuss Iraq's internal security. Spain's highest court convicted 21 people for their role in the 2004 Madrid rail station bombings. The three men many considered the masterminds were acquitted. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Barbara Slavin of USA Today, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, and syndicated columnist Steve Roberts. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane.
Secretary of State Rice is in Turkey. What's she doing, Barbara, to try to ease tensions over Kurdish rebels and the Iraqi border?
Well, there's a two-pronged approach. She's in Turkey, and the Turkish prime minister is coming to Washington. The hope is to calm down a crisis caused by these PKK guerrillas in northern Iraq who've been attacking across the Turkish border, have killed more than 40 Turkish soldiers in recent weeks. And it's interesting in a way, the Turkish government, the civilian government anyway, really does not want to attack. And they're kind of using U.S. intervention as a way to hold them back from doing something that they don't want to do anyway. But of course, there is pressure from public opinion. This is terrorism. And we'll see if Rice can and Bush can help. Rice is promising. She's promised on her way there that U.S. would take effective action, would help with more intelligence information to try to do something about this terrorism.
Is the U.S. going to become actively, physically involved in this effort?
I don't know actively physically, but as Barbara was saying, there are very strong incentives to avoid escalation of hostilities and violence there. The Turks are very committed and very interested in showing that they can curb this, but at the same time, they don't want to go to have any war. Two reasons, or actually three reasons. One is the European Union. They have made important progress in trying to liberalize the repression on which they had held the Kurds for many years in order to comply with conditions imposed by the European Union in order to allow Turkey to enter. That's the first. The second is the weather. The fighting in the mountains, on those mountains in winter, is not something that the Turkish military want to do. And third is that the Turkey needs their neighbors. They needs Turkey and Syria. The Kurds need Turkey and Syria to move their oil. Now there is a very important Turkish entity in Iraq that is is the most important oil producing sector in Iraq that needs to export that oil, and that oil goes through Turkey and Syria. So the last thing they want is to have hostilities there.
So what more can the Turkish Prime Minister ask of the U.S. when he comes to visit President Bush?
Well, actually,
the U.S. is materially involved with spy planes and providing intelligence already. And this is very useful information to the Turks to try to locate, as most said, this is a very mountainous area. These rebels have been very successful in hiding. If you have spy planes providing actionable intelligence where you can bomb or shell, very useful. I think they want the U.S. also to encourage the Iraqis to fortify that border. There was some sign this week that the Iraqis were saying, we're going to provide more troops on the border. We're going to check both ways, that we want to check the guerrillas moving from Iraq into Turkey and also supplies coming from Kurds in Turkey to the guerrillas.
But isn't Iraq also asking Iran for help in dealing with those Kurdish rebels?
Yeah, actually, this is one of a few issues where everybody kind of comes together on this, because the Iranians have their own Kurdish problem, a group called the PJAK, which is similar, related to the PKK, and the Iranians have been bombing them in northern Iraq. So the Iraqi government doesn't have the power to do much about this issue, but the Iranians could help, along with the Turks, and perhaps a little bit more effort from the Kurdistan government, the Iraqi Kurdistan government, to contain this.
You know, this foreshadows, you know, there's been so much talk, gathering talk, about their only real solution for Iraq is some sort of soft partition where you have three divisions in the country, the north ruled by the Kurds. And the main criticism of this idea, which has a lot of appeal, has been that this would be very troubling to the Turks, that it would lead to foreign intervention in these areas. And this trouble is foreshadows one of the problems you would have if you really move toward a partition.
So what's going to be discussed at next week's meeting in Istanbul, Barbara?
Well, there's also going to be the second of the regional meetings on Iraq at the ministerial level. The last one was in May in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, and you have the foreign ministers of Iraq and all the neighbors, plus, I think, the G8, Ban Ki-moon, a few others coming to talk about shoring up Iraq, shoring up stability through cooperation with the neighbors. Potentially, it could be a very interesting conference. I noticed that the tension between the U.S. and Iran seems a little less. Defense Secretary Gates said the number of these explosive devices from Iran appeared to be dropping rather dramatically. So perhaps that's a goodwill sign from the Iranians.
And what's the overall situation?
The larger news in the context of this is the decline in violence and killings in Iraq. Yesterday, the General Odierno in Iraq gave a press conference where he released a set of numbers that show that the violence, both against U.S. troops and against Iraqi civilians, has declined.
Is it temporary lull?
And that's the big question. And then the big question is this a lull or is this a structural decline? If you combine it with what Barbara was saying about Secretary Gates saying that the Iranian supply of these explosives that have been very, very damaging and very lethal, plus what's happening in some provinces in which the U.S. troops are working with the sheikhs and the local populations, and the general a sense of reaction among the Iraq population against al-Qaeda. All of that is a convergence of trends, but it's too soon to just pass judgment on what it all means.
Moises, how is all of this affecting the world economy?
This week we had a very seminal week in a variety of ways. We had gold, the price of gold reaching a 28-year high. We had the price of the British pound reaching a 26-year high. We had the euro, the European currency, reaching as more expensive than since it was launched against the dollar, and oil at $95 per barrel. Yesterday and today is at 93, but very, very high. Plus all of the jitters in the stock markets because of the subprime rate, subprime lending, plus big companies like Citibank posting huge losses. ExxonMobil, an oil company that despite huge oil prices is posting lower than anticipated earnings. So it is the world economy is somehow reflecting all of these volatility and all of these cross currents.
Well, also, you mentioned the tremendous importance here of oil and any threat. One of the reasons why people want to keep the Turks out of northern Iraq is that any kind of instability in that area immediately threatens oil supplies, which immediately has reverberations. And that is one of the keys to this whole
thing. Syndicated columnist Steve Roberts, Moises Naim, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, Barbara Slavin, she's senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today. She's author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's talk about what's happening in Pakistan. The AP is reporting extremists are gaining there. What are you hearing, Barbara?
Oh, there was also a very good piece in the New York Times this morning that said the same thing. There had been a theory that the Taliban and the pro-Al-Qaeda forces, extreme forces, were somehow segregated in these very isolated mountainous areas in western Pakistan. But it looks as though their influence is spreading, and it's scary. I mean, they've moved into some areas where they have not been powerful before. It almost gives one a feeling of the Taliban moving in Afghanistan some years back. And it appears that Pakistani forces are not doing well against them. They seem rather passive.
And what about Musharraf? Is he able to control anybody?
Well, clearly, he is not able to control these tribal regions. Now, as Barbara said, as long as it was isolated in these mountainous areas, yes, it was troublesome because this was the hideout for Osama bin Laden and a breeding ground for Al-Qaeda, but it was really not threatening Musharraf himself very much. Now you have the real possibility, if this spreads, that Musharraf becomes the target because of his cooperation with the United States.
And that he imposes some sort of
martial law. The Supreme Court is about to rule on the legality of his elections. And this is the country that many people think is, in the long run, as threatening as any. You can talk about, will Iran develop nuclear weapons at some point? Was Saddam Hussein thinking of it? We know they have them, and that makes them extremely important.
Syndicated columnist Steve Roberts. He's professor of journalism at George Washington University and author of My Father's Houses. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. Last week, Barbara Slavin, the State Department announced by email that some Foreign Service workers may be forced to take jobs in Iraq. Clearly, this is not sitting well with many State Department workers.
Now, I've been writing about this for some time, the impact of Iraq and Afghanistan, but particularly Iraq on the State Department. You know, since 2001, there's been a trebling of so-called unaccompanied posts. There are now something like 750 posts in the State Department that are so dangerous or difficult that you can't bring your family with you. And of that number, something like 250 are in Iraq. So it really is Iraq. So far, the State Department has been successful in getting people to volunteer for these jobs, but that is no longer the case. Something like 1,500 have already been cycled through. And as you point out, now they're having to force people to go.
But clearly the State Department does have the authority to tell people where they have to go.
It does, but it's not exercised this authority in a very long time, not
since
the Vietnam War. And Sean McCormick, the State Department spokesman, said since these emails had gone out, 15 more people have stepped up to the plate. So it's now 33 who may be forced to go if they can't find people to fill these positions. We were talking earlier about the issue, and one of the problems is that they do get the youngsters to go, but they're having trouble getting the seasoned mid-level people.
And that's who they need.
Well, and that's who they need, exactly.
It is who they need. Also, I think you're talking about people who are looking toward their careers. They're looking at this embassy. It's the biggest embassy in the world. There's an indefinite...
It's in the green zone, which is not protected.
And look, that's what Blackwater is there for, is to protect all these... If it wasn't so dangerous, you wouldn't have 900 Blackwater guards there. That's their paid mission. And so I think part of this also is that people who are sitting there in that auditorium, this extraordinary town meeting this week where someone got up and said it's a death sentence to go to Iraq, it's not just the ones who are going now. It's the ones who think 2, 3, 4 years from now in my career, I'm going to have to go because we're going to be there in that huge embassy. It's going to be dangerous indefinitely. The postings are going to be indefinite. And I think a lot of people saying, do I want to stay in the Foreign Service if that's in my future?
So that's the only alternative. You don't go, you quit.
Well, it's certainly if you don't follow orders, you take an oath. You were absolutely right. You take an oath. But to force people to go would have it be not only very demoralizing for the State Department forces.
Which is already demoralized.
It would be a tremendous confession of a failure of policy if sworn officers of your government are so against the policy they won't go.
Yeah, but there is a matter of principle here. These foreign service officers have signed a document and an oath and a commitment to go wherever the government decides they need to go. Imagine trying to manage American foreign policy if you don't have that tool. If you have highly dangerous hardship positions and you don't have the ability to staff them. So
maybe members of Congress should go.
Well,
truly. Members of Congress should go.
Dan, there's another aspect. State Department people have not been adequately prepared for this kind of assignment. We did some stories over the summer about people coming back with post-traumatic stress. It was only this summer that the State Department finally had a mental health survey for those who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places like this to see whether they might indeed be suffering from post-traumatic stress.
And look, it is no doubt that people signed an oath. You're absolutely right. But so did people in the National Guard. But they didn't necessarily sign up for this. And I think this is really the analogy.
And let's not forget that State Department employees signed up for diplomatic work,
right,
not necessarily work in war zones where war is literally taking place around them.
That's right. And under other circumstances, this embassy would have been closed and everyone but the most essential staff sent home.
Again, I think it's very important to rescue the principle.
A nation like
the United States cannot afford to have a situation where it cannot staff its embassies around the world. You may not like the strategy. You may not like the foreign policy. You may not like the context. I think there is a point about the training. But the general principle, let's not forget, is that a nation like the United States has to have the tool to staff.
But you can't draft Foreign Service officers and they can vote with their feet, just like National Guardsmen are voting with their feet and not resigning.
All right, let's talk about, you mentioned that Blackwater is there to defend these individuals, mm-hmm, and now the Iraqi parliament is considering lifting immunity for foreign private security workers. What does that mean for the Blackwater investigation going on now, Steve?
Well, it's very interesting. This immunity traces back 3 years to the administration of Paul Bremer, who was sort of the viceroy there, who in his wild days after the invasion issued this immunity order. It's very galling to the Iraqi parliament that this core of foreign contractors are outside their legal sovereignty. There's all this talk about the Iraqis are going to run their own government, except for our contractors who are going to be immunized from it. It's not retroactive, so you cannot go back prosecute people for past crimes. But there is a specific investigation here. The second part of this is there's a specific investigation into the Blackwater episode, the killing of 17 Iraqis. Now, several witnesses have been offered immunity in the sense that if they testify as to what they really know, that cannot be used against them. That's a fairly common use immunity, it's called. It's fairly common. The investigators are saying it's more valuable to have their information rather than prosecute them for what they say.
Moises.
There are 181 private security companies in Iraq that employ 48,000 employees. Only 1,000, less than 1,000 of those work for Blackwater. So the issue is larger than Blackwater, and
surely
it implies how the U.S. military is sized and staffed and trained to provide security to personalities, to diplomats, and so on.
Do we really have an accurate number, Moises, of either Blackwater or indeed the entire staff of private security?
I am referring this number, the 48,000 employees employed by 181 private security companies, is a General Accounting Office
report. Seen numbers higher than that.
And the point,
up
the general,
to 150,000.
Right, the general point is that we're talking about a lot of people and not just about Blackwater. That's
I
the
understand.
First point. Second point, and that it's perhaps has a larger implication, is that this incident has awoken an awareness or a thirst on the part of the Iraqi authorities to assert their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And the sovereignty is not only about private security forces. It's about bases. It's about the embassies, about the green zone. It's about a country that either has or does not have sovereignty, and they're going to increasingly try to expand their and assert the right to sovereignty, to sovereign decisions.
Well, of course, we have to remind the listeners that this followed in a particularly egregious incident in which 17 Iraqis were mowed down by Blackwater guards, most of them civilians, people who were stuck in a traffic jam and were caught in crossfire, some cases it appears deliberately targeted. So, you know, the Iraqi government had to do something to show it was responding to this situation.
Let's talk about Spain and the national court that sentenced defendants in the March 11th, 2004 attacks in Madrid. Is there anything surprising about these rulings, Moises?
Yes, there are two things. First is some of the people accused of having been the masterminds behind it and the leaders were acquitted, which shows the difficulty of using standard legal procedures in trying to bring the terrorists.
I don't understand. Explain.
They were acquitted. These were people that the security forces were convinced were the leaders of these attacks. Yet the proof that they had did not meet the standards of the Spanish legal code in order to convict them.
Yeah, that's a critical point because this has been an argument in this country over and over again. Can you use criminal law to prosecute terrorists? It's been one of the justifications for using Guantanamo and other procedures. And Moises is absolutely right. It shows how difficult it is to get witnesses to testify, to bring in the kind of evidence that really stands up in a court. And it's interesting that the prime minister, even though, of course, the families of the victims were very upset, the prime minister said, look, the judgment was fair, the system worked, but it does show the limits of using criminal law to prosecute terrorists.
Moises.
The other implication of the Spanish trial is what transpired in the trial and what we learned. We learned that these terrorists were homebred. No one from outside the countries funded them. They did not have contacts with Al-Qaeda. Iran didn't have anything to do with them. They were just radicalizing in Madrid. They became suicidal terrorists, some of them, even though it was not a suicide attack. But they became radicalized in Madrid. So this is the most threatening, the most scary trend, in which you have local populations that decide to kill their neighbors.
Barbara. I think one of the people who was found guilty actually was in a Moroccan jail for a while, if I'm not mistaken. So those that were convicted, two of the murder charges, two were of Moroccan origin. One was a Spaniard. And so, with some connection with Morocco and Islamic groups there.
Clearly, both Spanish politics and the people themselves are divided over this decision by the courts. Not very happy about it because of those three.
Well, and in fact, one of the mothers of one of the victims said, I have been given a life sentence because I think about my son every day, and yet the assassins have gone free.
But it's hard to argue with the verdict because the procedures were followed. And, you know, if you believe in the rule of law, you believe in the rule of law.
Steve, tell me about this dam in Iraq that is in danger of collapse. What are we talking about?
Well, it's a dam near the northern city of Mosul, which is was built about 30 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. It was built badly. It's built on a base of something called gypsum, a mineral called gypsum, which has a very unfortunate property for a dam. It dissolves in water. And so the whole thing has been collapsing from the beginning. They've been trying to shore it up by injecting kinds of concrete and other materials
and
into
money.
It. And yeah, it's like there's a million. It's like a pipeline of money being poured in. Maybe the dollar bills wadded up will protect the dam. But it's several things. First of all, it shows the vulnerability of the infrastructure of the country. If this were to break, it's been called the most dangerous dam in the world by some contractors. If it were to break, high-end possibility, 500,000 people could be killed by this flood.
Meanwhile, the Iraqi government spokesman who was on this program last week, Ali al-Dabah, said the Mosul Dam is in good condition and is not in danger. The dam is under constant observation by the Iraqi government, and all precautionary measures and needed maintenance are taken.
Yeah, but if they were there, according to the reports, they would see the leaks. Apparently, the leaks are very visible to anybody who's in the vicinity.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk briefly about the monks in Burma, Barbara, who have defied the military junta to stage a peaceful march. What's going on?
Yeah, this was just the other day in a city called Pakokku, I hope I pronounced that correctly, where there had been clashes earlier between the authorities and the monks. Apparently, this went off without a hitch. I think the Burmese have also released some of their prisoners this morning, if I heard correctly on NPR. So perhaps we're seeing a slight relaxation. The UN Special Envoy for Burma, Ibrahim Gambari, is also visiting Burma again. So, you know, maybe some tolerance for limited demonstrations as long as they don't become too large. And hopefully some solution coming to this crisis.
The only hope for the Burmese opposition and for getting rid of the horrible regime is international pressure, combined with a very strong internal movement, but that has been kept in check by the military junta for decades. The international consensus around Burma is eroding. And there is no longer enthusiasm or great interest in trying to pressure the Burmese junta into relaxing their repression. China and Russia are now backing Burma. India, that plays a very important role, has not shown any significant muscle in this. Australia, who had imposed sanctions on Burma, did not include gas and oil, which is the main source of revenues for the country and for the junta. And the numbers of monks in the streets have been declining, and the number of students have been declining. This will continue, but what I just want to point out is that the international community needs to be energized again around this.
There's one pressure point here, and that's the Olympics. And there is talk internationally of trying to raise pressure on China. The one thing China really wants from the rest of the world is a peaceful and respected Olympics. And that's one potential pressure point.
All right. And Argentina has elected its first female president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, wife of the outgoing president Nestor Kirchner. Under the Constitution, her husband could have run again, but announced this summer he was stepping aside in favor of his first lady. Nestor's decision to put his wife forward went unchallenged, Moises.
And the widespread perception is that that was just a gambit in order to allow him to run again after her, and thus perpetuating the Kirchner dynasty in Argentina. She inherits from her husband an impossibly difficult situation in the economy. Most economists do not believe that the situation in Argentina is sustainable. Inflation is one of the highest in the world. Price repressions, there are all sorts of prices that are forced and frozen by the government, which creates distortions, smuggling, and black markets that are very regressive because they hurt the poor.
How significant is it that Cristina is a woman and that she was elected?
It is significant. Well, it's a trend that we are witnessing throughout the world. Her neighbor, Michelle Bachelet in Chile, is also an elected woman.
Sort of a pink tide is what they're
and,
calling it.
But I do think it's fair to start to look at these as politicians and treat them as politicians that are part of a group that has had all sorts of criticism. And at the same time, they are in Latin America today, there is a significant political upheaval going on, for example, today as we speak in Venezuela.
Moises Naim, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. When we come back, it's time to open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, and by NPR stations, by Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs creating a greener tomorrow, on the web at kauffman.org, and by the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He's played a serial killer, a baseball player in a slump, a cavalry lieutenant who goes to live among Indians, and a federal agent out to get Al Capone. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor Kevin Costner. His latest film, Mr. Brooks, is now out on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup and not-so-good news from Pakistan. The AP is reporting that Islamic militant showed off 48 men on Friday, described as government troops who surrendered during bloody fighting in northwestern Pakistan, a humiliating display of the insurgents' growing power in the region. The rising violence has many Pakistanis worried that General Musharraf could extend his military rule by imposing a state of emergency or martial law, and the Bush administration is increasingly concerned about the stability of Pakistan.
They should be. It's the only appropriate response. And it shows how difficult Musharraf's position is, because from the American point of view, he's not doing enough to pursue al-Qaeda, to crack down on the lawlessness in the mountain, in the tribal areas, to deprive terrorists of a safe haven. But the Islamic fundamentalists are saying he's too close to the United States. And he's too much a toady. And that's the vice he's in.
And the BBC is reporting that a missile was launched in Pakistan's northern region. Pakistan military says it was not involved in the incident that reportedly killed several people. In Washington, the Pentagon has denied a U.S. drone plane from Afghanistan was involved. Moises.
As Steve was saying in the previous segment, the general subject is that Pakistan is one of the most dangerous countries in the world, and we get daily reminders of this. Today's New York Times has an article in which they report on a briefing that was prepared by the government of Pakistan about this region, the northwest border, and the essence is that of that report is that Talibanization, lawlessness, and terrorism are on the rise.
All right, let's go to East Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Jason. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I guess we have to limit our conversation to international.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Well, then I'll have to say that I kind of like Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. I know that people think he's a socialist or whatever, but I have a favorable opinion of him here in this country, and I wanted to know what your guest thought of that. And also, I can't help thinking that the leader of Argentina, the woman that was just elected, is reminiscent of Bill and Hillary Clinton, how they kind of switch places there.
All right, Jason, thanks for calling. Moises.
As we speak, there are thousands of students marching in the streets of Caracas, again for the second day, protesting President Chavez's attempt to perpetuate himself in power. He managed to propose and impose a constitution in 1999 that was designed essentially to suit his preferences and priorities. Now he has a new one that, among other items, includes the possibility that he may stay in power permanently, and has many other provisions that, after reading them, you have to decide if you like to live in a country like that. And probably most listeners would not like to live in a country with a constitution like the one President Chavez is very likely to impose in the country.
And here's an email from David in Annandale, Virginia, who says, I'm a retired Foreign Service officer. While the service does require worldwide availability, and that's in quotes, the assumption is that this involves pursuing the requirements of diplomacy and interaction and reporting on the realities of the host country. Assignment to Iraq today is to a war zone, having served in the army in Vietnam. An assignment to the green zone would be akin to being stationed on a fire support base without the ability to counter incoming mortar rounds. I'm with those who believe the forced assigning is a break in trust with the Foreign Service, Barbara.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I believe, because the new embassy is not yet finished, that a lot of these State Department people are living in aluminum trailers, which can be penetrated very easily by mortars and rocket fire. They don't have weapons. They're not in the military. And there's a big question about what kind of job they can do in terms of what a diplomat is supposed to do under that sort of environment.
There's also a history here, because in a way they're being asked to clean up the Pentagon's mess, because for a long time the Pentagon said, we're in charge. This was the whole Rumsfeld Doctrine. The military is going to do all of this. Obviously, they failed in many ways at nation building, which George Bush said he was not going to do anyway. And now they're handing it over to the diplomats to try to do these jobs, which are extremely dangerous and extremely difficult, because they really have no model for how to operate in this situation.
And here's another along that line. I'm a former state communications officer. I maintained a top secret crypto clearance during my tenure. I also worked for Ambassador Crocker for 2 years at another danger pay post, where I received an award for sustained superior performance. I've been working back in a civilian job for about 10 years, but did not leave the Foreign Service under any kind of cloud. I have volunteered repeatedly for state's Baghdad posts and even for plain vanilla communications positions, temporary or permanent. I'm 49 years old. I've received no interest whatsoever. I can just imagine how Foreign Service employees feel about mandatory unaccompanied postings to Iraq. It's a very stressful and grinding type of life in those conditions, and about all you do is work. It's going to be a tough situation to get people who don't want to go. I'm going now to Somerville, Arkansas. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning. I wanted to ask if any of the panel been to the website of the president of Iran.
Yeah.
Barbara?
I have, not lately, but I have in the past, yes, checked it out. Is there something new there?
I don't know if it's new or not, but I'd like to just point out just a couple of things. First of all, he says it's illogical to foment crisis in Iraq. Then he says that atomic bombs have no influence, absolutely no influence. And then he talks about the Palestinian Jew, Muslim, and Christian one vote rule and urges the Palestinian groups to have closer cooperation with one another. Then he says that Hezbollah is a popular political group, and he doesn't understand why some people think that they realize the interest of the Lebanese nation better than the Lebanese people do. And then the most beautiful thing is that he says that we need to take advantage of such opportunities to present the positions of the Iranian people to the Americans, as they are keen to hear them. And there's no reason to think that the United States and Iran are on the path to war.
Barbara.
Well, that sounds like Ahmadinejad. Sounds like he's gotten a better writer, too, in terms of presenting his views. Iran, has always denied that it's trying to get nuclear weapons, has always said that they're not of any utility. Unfortunately, they have a program which they hid for nearly two decades, which suspiciously looks like it's aimed toward getting, if not weapons, at least the capacity to make weapons. And Hezbollah is indeed a popular movement in Lebanon. It's also a movement that's been associated with terrorism in the past, and which is being used by the Iranians, apparently in Iraq, also to train Shia groups. So there are two sides to every story, and I'm glad you're checking out his website. It's good that he's putting his views forward.
Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to ask your guests what their reaction to this plan would be. Having the United States covertly back a Sunni secular strongman and end the possibility of Iranian involvement in Islamism and establish a permanent base in Kurdish areas so that we can keep stability in the event of any regional problems. I know there'd be a public outcry and along the world, but if we do this covertly, it may be the best of many evils.
Moises.
Well, that was the hope in the past. And in fact, that trend, that it's part of the soft federalism that is being proposed by some, in which you will have three regions, the Kurdish, the Shiite, and the Sunni in Iraq. And that, in fact, is happening. The fact of partition of the country, soft and very complex, is happening. What has not emerged is that strongman or a leader.
Am I missing something? Or wasn't Saddam Hussein?
We had that strongman.
He was a Sunni secular strongman.
Yeah. Yes. You can't get him back.
But the point is that, yes, the caller is absolutely right that there are people that are looking for someone.
To bring it all back again?
To rally the Sunnis around the...
It's not just that. There's a key word, secular, here, because part of the enormous difficulty in getting political progress, even with all the military calming down, is the enormously powerful religious feelings that people have, the Shias and the Sunnis, against each other. And so the notion of finding a secular figure who is not a part of the religious rivalries but allowing to some extent was an attempt to find a secular figure.
It's not possible.
Too.
You cannot bring Saddam back from the grave. Okay, he was that strong man. The country has fractured, as Moises points out. You have a very strong Shia sector now. So, it would be nice, but the U.S. decided to overthrow Saddam.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, David. David, are you there? Okay. How about to LT in Dallas, Texas?
Yes, ma'am. Diane, I want to say that Bush forgave Pakistan 2 weeks after the trouble started over there. Bush gave Pakistan clearance for $3.7 billion of debt. And at 7 o'clock that morning and 4 o'clock that evening, Pakistan only owed $700 million. Bush gave Pakistan $3 billion in less than 12 hours to keep the Taliban out. And lest we forget that the atomic bomb has been declared as a political weapon over 20 years ago, and we ain't got enough people that's in this world, let alone in the United States, to know enough about the atomic. The Jews built the atomic bomb. They think they're gonna let Israel give up their inspection of.
All right, LT, thanks for calling. Barbara.
Yeah, well, I think U.S. has given $8 billion in military aid to Musharraf over the last five, 6 years.
But is LT right?
I believe, yes, the U.S. also
debt forgiven.
The U.S. also forgave the debt, so billions and billions, and it doesn't appear to have been enough.
Well, yeah. There was this talk about
perhaps
a strong...
Perhaps it was too much.
There was this talk about, you were half kidding about Saddam, you can't bring him back from the grave, but Musharraf is a strong man in a situation where we have invested a lot because he's the only person, at least at this point, we think can hold the country together.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To Ann Arbor, Michigan, and to Zana, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, madam. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks, sir. Go right ahead.
Madam, a question I want to ask is, lately American media has been very biased toward the question of the Kurdish and Turkish issue. They always discuss what the PKK or the Kurds have been done, but they never discuss what the Turk has been done in this past decade to the Kurds. So I hope that you will dedicate a show to that subject.
Thanks for the suggestion.
It's a good point. I served out there as a correspondent. I traveled in the Kurdish regions of Turkey. And the caller is right. There's been a long history of repression against the Kurds by the Turkish government. They've banned the Kurdish language. They have basically pretended that the Kurds were not an independent ethnic group. Kurdish leaders have been jailed. There's a long history of repression of Kurdish nationalism. Now, the Kurds have responded with the guerrilla warfare. But the caller is right. That there is a lot of grievances the Kurds have against Ankara, which are justified.
Yeah, but the irony is that the current Turkish government has very much changed that policy, and now Kurdish can be spoken. They've done a lot in terms of economic development, perhaps not enough. But the irony is that this group, the PKK, they're feeling irrelevant. That's one of the reasons that they're mounting these attacks, because they're worried that they will be co-opted. Their co-religionist, co-ethnic group will be co-opted by the government in Ankara.
All right, let's go to Annandale, Virginia. Good morning, John.
How are you, Diane?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment about the Foreign Service officers being directed to Baghdad.
Sure.
I have done, in the past 2.5 years, I've spent about 18 months in Iraq, a good deal of that time in the IZ, and I worked very closely with a number of folks at State Department. And I have to tell you that I just find it's a lot of belly aching. Yes, we do live in trailers. As for protection, some of the projects I've worked on have been force protection projects where we harden structures. For the most part, I can't think of any dwelling quarters in the IZ that are not now protected. There are some that do not have overhead cover yet, but that's being addressed right now. As far as the other amenities, you have to eat in a dining hall. It's not four-star cuisine, but it's fine. And you are away from your family. But you'll find that State Department folks get very frequent R&Rs, much more frequent than contractors that I've worked with.
John, I want to thank you for your service through the Department of State to the Foreign Service. Barbara, you want to make a comment?
Well, you know, he should talk to some of the people that I've interviewed who've come back with extreme post-traumatic stress, people who've had friends, Iraqi employees who've been murdered on their way to work, there one day, gone the next, people who feel that they're accomplishing nothing, who feel that their very presence is simply endangering Iraqis as well as themselves. This is a complicated issue, and not everybody comes out of there in such great shape.
And it's not just about the food or the housing. It's about the larger disagreement with the mission. I think a lot of Foreign Service officers have never agreed with the basic Bush policy, and that's part of the background situation here.
And that's got to be the last word. Syndicated columnist Steve Roberts, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Barbara Slavin of USA Today, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.